welcome to The Final Draft, your weekly half hour dedicated to books and writing. I'm Genevieve McGregor. Tonight, we're taking a look at the continuing growth of online literary magazines and what it offers the young, the loyal, and the down and out. We speak with those behind a mysterious new literary project devoted to TV called The Channeling. And we meet Mark Mordew, who is tired of bloodless travel writing and devoted his issue of an online magazine to bringing it back to life. We also revisit an interview from earlier this year with Ivor Indyke about the end of his magazine Heat and the possibility of its online rebirth, all coming up on The Final Draft. Last week, mysterious messages started being released over Twitter, with young writers tweeting about a mysterious entity called The Channeling. It turns out that The Channeling is a new literary magazine devoted to TV. I don't know how that works, but we're going to find out. The Channeling was created as part of the Literary Magazine in a Week project, a one-hour workshop devised and run by Sam Tyford-Moore as part of the National Young Writers Month, an initiative of Express Media. The first workshop was held at the New South Wales Writers' Centre. Kim Tan from Final Draft spoke to two of Channeling's editorial team, Jackie Dent and Sam Tyford-Moore, on the day of the launch.
It seems today that all you see is violence in movies and sex on TV. But where are those good old-fashioned values on which we used to rely?
I'm here with Jackie Dent at the New South Wales Writers' Centre. And Jackie is an editor and a contributor for a new literary magazine called The Channeling. Hello, Jackie.
Hello.
So how did word get out about what you would be writing about thematically? Because obviously the launch was today and it was very hush-hush on the Twitter sphere about what The Channeling actually was. Did Sam kind of send covert emails to everyone about what it was?
Oh, well, I mean, we were pretty secretive on Twitter about what it was, but our first meeting, basically the main purpose of the meeting was to work out what our magazine would be and what it would be about. So we decided fairly early on that we wanted to do a television writing theme, and then we all had to agree on articles that we would write for the magazine. Several of us changed our minds. I changed my mind. I didn't write the thing that I said I was going to write in the meeting.
Initially
I was going to write about TV box sets and the way that it changes our viewing experience. I now pretty much no longer watch television on the television. I get the box set of the series and I watch it in about 2 days. So I was going to write about how that changes the way that we experience television. But in the end, I got talking to Sam and we realized that I was much more passionate of writing about my kind of maybe embarrassing obsession with made-for-television movies of terrible, terrible quality, particularly one movie called Mega Shark versus Giant Octopus. And my thesis basically was that as writers, we can learn as much from watching crap as we can from reading literary masterpieces. So my article is about what we can learn as writers from Mega Shark versus Giant Octopus.
What is Mega Shark versus... I mean, it's an awesome title.
What more do you need to know?
Self-explanatory, I guess.
It
really
is a fairly self-explanatory title. It's a made-for-TV film, obviously. So it was released straight onto the Sci-Fi Network and released straight onto DVD. And it's basically one of the worst films that I've ever seen in my life. the premise is that these prehistoric creatures, Mega Shark and Giant Octopus, are unfrozen for some reason and they start wreaking havoc on the world, and Mega Shark eats a plane. It's on YouTube, look it up. Shark eats plane. It's magnificent. I love it so much.
Whoa.
Please sit down, sir. It's just in your pocket. Thank you.
I'm getting married in 2 days.
It'll be fine.
All right, folks, please fasten your seatbelts.
Holy shit!
Ah!
grandiose scale, I guess. Wow. Okay. I guess country of origin.
No, it's a US. It's a US film, and they now have a sequel which has just come out called Mega Shark versus Crocosaurus.
You wouldn't think it was possible to draw any more material out
there
of something
is so
like that.
It actually inspired a whole bunch of other films. Like, I'm trying to remember the name of it. Mega Python versus Gatoroid. There's Dinocroc. There's Dinocroc versus something else. There's a whole. It's an underground film movement.
So, Sam Twyford-Moore, Jackie calls you the main instigator. So how would you describe yourself?
The National Young Writers Month came to me wanting to use the Writers' Centre, and so I was working at the Writers' Centre, but also asked me to run a workshop, and so I devised a literary magazine in a week workshop idea and then ran it there. But it was also kind of my workplace because it was at the Writers' Centre, but they were only as a venue.
And I've got to point out, because we sussed that out with Jackie, that in terms of a literary magazine, it's actually a blog that's run on Tumblr or hosted on Tumblr at the moment, yeah?
Yes.
Okay. Why do you call it a literary magazine, though?
It's a literary magazine.
Mm-hmm.
But I think in the changing sort of sphere of publishing, you kind of have to now include just stuff that's put online, and whether that's on Tumblr or Blogger or WordPress, that all kind of counts. Like, it just it depends on if you've got readers or not. If it's on Tumblr, that's fine.
Why have you called it The Channeling?
The Channeling? So The Channeling came... The whole point of the idea was to have a one-hour workshop where people got together and talked for an hour and tried to come up with a concept. And at the end of the hour, we actually had the title, which was pretty amazing. To put together a literary magazine and have the title within an hour was pretty fine. Now, not all of us were certain on The Channeling, but it came up. And I think it just kind of represented, you know, talking about television, but talking about it in a sort of slightly intelligent way.
Yeah.
It's not the guide, it's the channeling.
I know that with The Channeling, you guys are looking to make podcasts.
Yes.
Mm. How will that happen?
That will eventually happen. That's only in the very early stages. There's not really much to say about that. But I think it's something that I'm very interested in, and I think it comes back to the idea of putting content and literary content online, which is finding new ways and sort of keeping up with trends almost that are in this new space, and ways to get literary or high-minded ideas, if you like, out to the masses. And it's kind of like, well, podcasting is something that I listen to a lot, but it's kind of not being done in Australia.
Mm-hmm.
Just in terms of sort of more literary style things, and if that's about television, that's okay, but kind of getting that content out there in different ways. And so being on Tumblr is kind of interesting, and sort of doing that and just putting up articles online that you'd normally see in a book but are online. But, podcasts are something I'm very interested in.
In all honesty, The Channeling is also quite comparable with something like Television Without Pity. Have you...
Television, is that a thing? Online thing?
Yeah, it's an online thing that's been running for a long time. I think since probably the late 90s. But it's more like
a journal.
In terms
of not feeling guilty about watching television.
Yeah, but it's more like, I guess, they'll follow series and they will critique them. So it's almost like a journal, more so.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, the only television writing that I really read online, other than Troy Patterson's reviews on Slate.com, is the AV Club TV Club, where they kind of, they follow a series and sort of review it every week. But that's not quite what we're doing. I mean, it's kind of, it was interesting sitting on the Lit Mag in a week workshop where it was like sitting down and talking about what we wanted the theme to be, and television seemed to be an easy and natural thing to write about, but none of us actually owned a television, or if we did own a television, it didn't actually have reception. But it was something that we watched on DVD and watched sort of in increments, not necessarily, sat down and watched 3 hours of television a night, but watched quality TV on DVDs for a couple of hours a week. And that's kind of more interesting to write about. I mean, that's kind of more how you'd approach a book than how you'd necessarily approach traditional television. You know, we're not sitting down watching Today Tonight. We're watching The Wire or Mad Men on DVD for an hour a week, sort of how you'd sit down and read a book, really.
In terms of the editorial team's vision, Sam, what do you think is going to happen with this literary magazine of yours?
I think choosing television as a theme was quite an interesting choice because television doesn't really stop. It goes 365 days a year and there's always going to be content there to write about. And the way that we were approaching it in terms of actually writing about television was to kind of use television as a starting point and then to sort of spin off into the personal essay after reviewing a show. So I think a number of the essays on there do that. And I think the amount of television that's produced and the way it sort of dominates discussion allows that. In the short term, we have pieces on Doctor Who coming up and pieces on MasterChef, and so there are natural topics that come up. And I think that just television provides that amount of content and that it can continue. I think in terms of creating a literary magazine that's centred around television, you're not really going to run out of topics. It's just a matter of setting up an editorial team that want to continue with putting stuff online and are excited about putting stuff online.
What has the response been like for the channeling? You've promoted it through Twitter, you know, in terms of followers and readership and buzz, general buzz in the community, in literary community.
Yep.
What's the response been like?
That's interesting. It's the first time I've promoted something exclusively on Twitter. I think the response was really great. It actually came from more sort of established people in the community. We got the Australian literary critic put it on his Facebook. The Lifted Brow down in Melbourne were really responsive and said that it was a really good idea. In terms of actual readers, that's a bit hard to gauge at this early stage, but hopefully as the content comes in and maybe moving it away from Tumblr and putting it on an actual website and sort of establishing it a little bit more, maybe the readers will come.
That was Kim Tan speaking with some of the Channeling's editorial team. You can find it online at thechannelling.tumblr.com or follow the links that I'll put up on our website. And you're listening to The Final Draft on 2SER, and tonight we're talking with some online crusaders. Later in the show, reviving travel writing online with Mark Mordew. But first, as we heard in the last interview, the most nail-biting part of editing a magazine is whether there is anyone out there to read it. The success of print editions is based on physical sales and subscriptions, and for that exact reason, earlier this year, the publication Heat published its final edition, appropriately titled That's It For Now. In February, I spoke to the founding editor, Ivor Indyke, about grants, readers, and the possibilities of online. So I want to start off with, could you tell me a bit about how and why you established Heat and what the vision and the drive was?
Well, I was editing thoroughly. And it was a very traditional academic literary magazine. And I wanted something more exciting and something more pitched more to the marketplace because it was so academic. It was largely read by academics and English teachers. So that was the first thing. And the second thing was that the Demidenko affair blew up in 1996, I think. And I was really angry about that book winning all the prizes. And the constituency I sort of represented as an academic and as an editor was writers of migrant background and emerging writers. And that book really compromised both of those categories very badly. So I called the new magazine Heat for both those reasons. I wanted something that was exciting and something that was kind of full of intensity and anger and provocation.
After 14 years, it is over. And do you think that you succeeded in your vision?
I don't think the vision is fully implemented. That couldn't be the case. But I think we established enough of it for it to stop and to be complete in itself. I think it stands as an achievement in its own right. And I really didn't want it to just go on and on, you know, for 50 years or 70 years, just for the sake of enduring. I thought that the vision would get diluted if that was the case.
And an online version would have an international, well, it would have an infinite audience.
Yeah, well, but I do distinguish between online and e-book because online is simply, you know, on the internet. And I don't think that's a good place to read. It's a good place to get information and to advertise and to sell. But to read, it really should be downloaded into an e-book. And if that is the case, then it has to have a design which suits that new technology. that new format. The ebook, you know, offers so many possibilities in terms of choice, selection, combination, and the mediums, the media themselves, because you're not restricted to text.
And you mentioned that the sales have not grown, but this is a discrepancy with the amount of readers who you met who knew about the magazine.
Yes.
How do you explain that?
Well, Patrick Allington, who published a novel last year from Adelaide, has a blog at the moment in which he talks about it, and in which he admits that he followed it, he read every single issue, maybe not cover to cover, but he certainly read every issue, and he never bought a copy in 14 years. So that's the problem. That's a real problem. There's a lot of people, especially, you know, we appeal a lot to writers, obviously, because they want to know what's going on. They read it in libraries or in bookshops themselves without actually buying it, you know, just standing up or sitting down, browsing through it. So that's been the killer for us. The actual number of sales would be, you know, around 1,000 on a good day. And while we're heavily supported, you know, by the Literature Board and by the University of Western Sydney in our case, you just want to feel that people are reading, and the only way you can know that is if they're actually buying it and getting back to you and talking about it and so on. And I think finally I just got dispirited, I have to say, about not being confident that there was a readership out there.
There was another point you made in the editorial that you said that going into an e-book could raise the medium of literary magazine from a second-class citizen in the world of books to its right place. Can you tell me a bit about that?
Well, I really, right throughout those 14 years, I felt the second-class nature of the literary magazine. First of all, because when it started, you know, the big multinational publishers had been in the country for maybe 3 or 4 years. They were from the early 90s on. And they were ravenous for fiction. That was the only literary category that was commercial, possibly commercial from their point of view. And so they were just scooping up young novelists wherever they could find them. And traditionally, novelists in Australia had their training, their apprenticeship in the literary magazines. You know, they would publish short stories first and then move up to longer fictional works. And so people like Peter Carey and Elizabeth Jolly, and they all came up through the literary magazines. But in the 90s, there was no time for that. The big publishers wanted them right now, and they were offering big advances. And so we've always had a battle to get fiction into the magazine, because the prose writers, their first responsibility, they think, is to their book publishers. And in that respect, you know, to publish something in a magazine was like something you did with your offcuts or your excerpts or something like that. There, I think, quite literally, we were regarded as second class. But we were also treated as second class in the bookshops, because although we tried as hard as we could to make the magazine look like a book, gave it an ISBN, gave it a title, presented the editor as the author, they still didn't believe it, really. And they put it on the floor or near the floor or near newspapers, things like that, you know, next to the TLS or that kind of weekly or monthly journal.
And what are you going to do now? I mean, obviously, Giramondo Books will continue.
Yeah.
What do you think you'll do personally?
Well, it's just been a huge effort. You know, 30 authors an issue, that's 90 to 100 authors a year. That's a lot of work, editing and so on. So we should have time freed up.
You started off as a critic. Do you think you'll...
Yeah, that's what I really want to do. I want to buy some time. Yes, I want to create some time for myself. See, the problem in Australia, and I think it's because the literary community is so small, is that you often find yourself playing more than one role, like two or three different roles. And that's been true of Australian literature really from the beginning. You know, someone like A.G. Stevens, who was the editor of the Red Page of the Bulletin, a great literary figure at the turn of the 19th, 20th century. He was an agent, an editor, a writer, a publisher, a critic, five different roles. And, you just kind of juggle hats. And so at certain times it's more important to be one than another, I think. Right now I just like to be a critic.
That was Ivor Indyk, founding editor of Heat magazine, which will hopefully return in a new form soon. Now we step into the realm of travel literature. Mark Mordieu is a writer and journalist and the editor of the travel issue of online magazine The Group. As you will hear, he thinks that the space for intimate and challenging travel stories has been crowded out by popular culture and the callous supplements in a weekend newspaper. He saw editing his own travel issue as a chance to champion travel literature with guts. Mark spoke with Madeline James last year and began by talking about what he understands travel writing to mean.
I've always interpreted the idea of travel writing very broadly because I think travel and memoir always tend to overlap, and my loose sense of that is, you know, that as you travel through the world also travels through you, and most of the great travel writers generally also have a pretty strong personal voice to them.
That's Mark Mordieu, co-founder of the Group Online magazine and editor of issue number 4, the travel issue.
The Group's an online magazine that basically functions by membership, which is to say that you have to be a member to contribute, but you don't have to be a member to read it. There's a functioning blog out there on the web called the Group Online magazine, brilliantly enough. That's there for anyone to read, but if you want to submit, you actually have to become a member of the group. It sounds like a sort of sinister 1970s sci-fi film or a late 60s psychedelic pop group that failed in London, I think, but it was the best name that we could come up with. It was originally a concept by Larry Buttrose, and then Billy Marshall Stone King chipped in, and myself and John Birmingham and James Bradley. The concept was that each person would take a turn editing an edition, and the group issue 4 has been edited by me, and I've gone with the theme of travel, journeys and place. And there's going to be upcoming issues soon, edited by James Bradley. And I think John Birmingham's doing a food issue, which I would imagine would be a hell of a lot more interesting than the weekend supplement food issues that you see floating around like fish and chip paper. Not that I should mention fish and chip paper and food issues in the same breath as those celebrity chef type things, but there you go.
Speaking of celebrity chef type things, in your introduction you talk about the concept of the journey being kind of appropriated by reality TV shows.
Yep.
And you've got a very kind of loose concept of travel writing in this issue. There's a lot of memoir, there's a kind of story of a woman's introduction into roller derby, there's video and animation, and I suppose if you can elaborate on what you mean by travel and journey for, as a personal
okay.
concept.
Without kind of sounding too new age, I think travel is very much about personal journeys as well as about reportage. It's as much about photojournalism as it is about stories that could be about, you know, hanging out with friends and smoking bongs in the western suburbs of Sydney, or kind of trying to deal with a mixed-up love affair in your mind while you're travelling through India, or trying to kind of reconcile in some way a relationship with your sister or your dead father, or whoever the case may be. I mean, look, you know, I like So You Think You Can Dance as much as anybody, but you do get a little bit sick of how cheaply the word journey is used. And I guess what I'd like to sort of think with the current issue of the group is that the journeys that people take you on are reasonably idiosyncratic and original in some way, and therefore also refreshing to people who might look at it if it's a set of images, or read it if it's a story, be it about a place or a relationship, as the case may be. You know, good travel writing and good imagery and sort of thinking and feeling behind it should take you places in some sort of imaginative sense. That, you know, it should be a transporting experience. You know, I think it's a pity that what people think of as travel writing in newspapers and magazines, for the most part, is generally pretty poor, generally about how you get there, how much it costs, whether the hotel was any good. It's pragmatic, but, you know, when you sort of turn to the books of the last sort of decade or more, the writing about place and about travel and about landscape has been amongst some of the best non-fiction that you could read, and that just doesn't seem to have filtered through because the newspapers and magazines have been captured by such a strong commercial imperative. It's really just marketing for hotels and airlines and various places, all free junkets for writers that aren't up to the task of what they're writing about.
just sound bitter and twisted about it. Yeah. What is it, any wonder that the print media is in trouble? Yeah, a lot of what is kind of perpetuated is just not that interesting and not that sincere, for want of a better word. I think there's a real heart to a lot of the work in the latest issue of the group. I think it's a product of people's passion, and I think that sincerity is worth something.
I really enjoyed the way Adair Jones, when she was talking in her story about travel writers who've come to Australia and written about Australia, American travel writers.
Yep.
And in talking about Bill Bryson and In a Sunburnt Country, she makes the comment that Australians can learn just as much about Americans from reading Bill Bryson's book about Australia as Americans will learn about Australia.
Oh, yeah, that's totally true. It's like the Da Vinci quote, the portrait painter always paints himself, and I think writers reveal themselves by intent or by accident or some strange kind of shadowy mix of the two. There's always sort of a subtext to things. There's what you're saying expressly and what you're implying and what you haven't realised you've kind of let out of the bag. But, you know, there's some stuff in the group online that I think is really good. Like you mentioned Jacinta Walpole's piece before, on being sort of involved with the roller derby. Like, that sort of got a mix of humour and kind of anger and exploration to it that I think is really interesting. Jason Child's piece, 438, about just being on a bus and being harassed by very strange guys, an experience most people could associate with. But it's positively hallucinogenic the way he writes about it, as well as being very, very funny. And then something like Ben Rumble's piece about, you know, helping someone move out of a house where they used to kind of play, you know, bad rock and roll with their sort of band and have cones and smoke cigarettes, is written with a real affection, and there's a kind of depth of feeling and a sort of nostalgia to it. And there's even, you know, much more powerful things, again, in some ways, or more deeply personal things, like Bonnie Rando Lee's piece about her mother's struggle with cancer. I just think the possibilities are endless. That's all the memoir stuff. And then you've got people imagining a kind of quasi Brett Whiteley type death, in the way that Nicholas Hopkins did in The Inevitable Death of an Artist. And on it goes.
Do you think the same thing goes for the editor, that we can learn about Mark Mordew through what you've picked?
Yeah, probably. I mean, I wondered about that, you know, in terms of things I was selecting for the issue. I guess for me, I've just been thinking of it less about my kind of curatorial stroke editorial process and more about the possibilities that maybe the internet, as you see things like Kindle kind of developing and the like, that the delivery of information might be very favourable to online magazines. You can kind of curate the information that's out there because there's so much on the net, you just get lost.
In terms of the online nature of it, it gives you the chance to not just be reliant on text-based or image-based work, that you can have things like the Cambodian Space Project video clip.
Yeah.
Or the ecstasy of Gary Green, the neon animation, which I love.
Oh, yeah, look, I would have loved to have taken that further, but I'm kind of hoping that the seriousness of the mix and the attempt to kind of combine the level of writing and images with those other things is something that's, you know, worthwhile and interesting. You've got to remember that the whole project's just sort of casual and non-paying, so there's definitely a loose energy behind it, but I think you can kind of see the sort of tendrils of where it's sort of reaching.
That was Madeline James speaking with Mark Mordew. And that's all we have time for this evening. We'll be back next Monday at 7 p.m. Until then, go to 2SER.com and follow the links to find Final Draft for more info and to download the podcast too. On the Corner is up next, so stay tuned.